Construction financing carries a higher risk profile than most other loan categories. But even in today's uncertain climate, some lenders are not only keeping a hand in this category, but embracing it. One example is Kennedy Wilson. In a blockbuster $4.1 billion deal last year, the LA-based investment company bought the construction loan portfolio from Pacific Western Bank. That milestone acquisition helped double Kennedy Wilson's debt origination portfolio to $7 billion. Hi, and welcome back to Investment Matters. I'm Paul Rosta, Executive Editor at CPE. In this episode, we'll hear from Tom Weitzel, who heads the debt investment group at Kennedy Wilson. He tells why construction lending is a sweet spot for the company today and shares insights on how the real estate capital markets will respond when the Federal Reserve eventually does start lowering interest rates. Weitzel offers a lender's perspective on which commercial real estate assets are most attractive right now and weighs in on a hot topic for CRE investors. What makes an office property a good candidate for conversion to multifamily? Some of his answers might surprise you. Take a listen. Tom Weitzel, welcome to Investment Matters. Really nice to have you as our guest today.
Thank you for having me here.
So one of the top of mind issues right now is, of course, the conditions of the capital markets. And could you give us a snapshot of the most important issues that are influencing the real estate capital markets right now? Is it really all about what the Fed is going to do, or are there some other factors at work in your view?
I do think that the biggest issue has been and will continue to be inflation and the impact that that has on what the Fed will do. You know, this week's report on March's inflation numbers indicated a rise of 3.5% year over year. And that was slightly higher than February's, which was like a 3.2. So this has obviously impacted the Fed's decision on if and when it's going to cut rates. You know, the consensus a month ago was that there would be three cuts and we'd see one in June. I don't think it's going to happen in June based on the March numbers right now. I think it's going to be later. I mean, the issue really is it going to be July or September? You know, is there going to be three? Is there going to be two cuts? We just don't know right now. And then you got the election coming up and, you know, the Fed wants to stay out of politics altogether. So, you know, they don't want to be accused of helping one candidate or the other. So I think now it seems like maybe July is maybe would be the first one. I think they do need to cut one at least before the election. So maybe two. We'll see. But obviously with the rates where they're at, that has a big impact on real estate, and it, you know, it will continue to keep transaction volume low. I mean, you know, we're seeing 2023 was a very slow year for transaction volume, and we aren't seeing a big uptick yet, and that's just because of the interest rates, you know, are just still too high for a lot of transactions, especially when, you know, cap rates were low and interest rates low and everything worked at the lower rates. So I think that's going to be the biggest part of it, and I think a lot of the money that's sitting on the sideline is just sitting out there until they see, you know, a rate cut or two.
I see. And when the Fed does finally cut rates, whatever the date is, what will be the effect on commercial real estate lending? And however you would like to approach that, for example, are there any categories of lenders that are likely to become noticeably more active relatively quickly to some other categories? Whether it's the commercial banks, life companies, private debt funds, or other sources, how do you see the impact shaping up initially?
Yeah, I do think there'd definitely be like kind of a ripple effect after the very first Fed cut. If we see one cut, I think what the people, you know, in the market are going to believe is that the Fed is going in that direction. It's just not a one-off, and they're not going to do just one and then be done. I think they're going to be one, two, but maybe slow it down, but at least they're going directionally lower. And once that happens, I do think that it won't be quite a watershed, but it's going to be a big opening in confidence of investors and lenders to put money out. I mean, definitely your LP money will start coming in because they're going to think deals will start working. And I think on the lending side, I think it will open up primarily for the debt funds. The debt funds have been wanting to put money out, and they have in certain markets and all that. But I think you're going to see them, you know, increase their business dramatically. Life companies definitely will as well. Life companies have become more active in the last, bit here. And also, I think also even CMBS will even be, things will start penciling better for CMBS right now. If that happens, when rates happen, I think banks are still going to be slow. I think some of your major banks and a couple select regional banks will be able to continue to, you know, push deals and get more active in the lending. But I think generally banks are still going to be a little bit slow. They're going to have to lick their wounds here. Capital ratios are out of whack. There's more and more regulation for a lot of these regional banks that they're going to have to deal with. And I honestly think that the Fed's been a little bit soft on some of these banks just because there's a lot of office in the banks. Again, not crazy amount, but enough that there's going to be some pretty major hits that they haven't had to deal with yet. And they're going to have to unload those properties. I think it's going to be the debt funds are going to be the biggest ones and the biggest beneficiaries of it. Because also, if you think about it, a lot of debt funds get financing and leverage their returns by going to banks. And then, so some of the major banks will provide leverage for them at a much lower, safer basis.
We're referring to this as a ripple effect once the Fed finally does start cutting rates. And in your view, what is the lag time before any or all of these lenders start to maybe adjust their strategies a little bit? Is it something that will happen pretty soon once the Fed starts to lower rates? Is there going to be a little bit more of a lag before investors and other stakeholders start to see the impact of the rate cuts?
I personally think the first rate cut, lenders will, I think already what's happening right now, a lot of lenders are amping up and being prepared to go after it, but they just can't pull the trigger yet. But as soon as that first rate cut hits, I think you're going to see an immediate effect. I think it's going to be immediate. And then I do think what happens then is that you're going to see more aggressive financing or financing that wasn't even there, but it, by definition, that's more aggressive, right? And then what you're going to see is more LP money coming in to deals. And I do think that will be that's what everyone's waiting for. They're just waiting for interest rates to drop. Once they do that, you're going to see activity because there's just way too much money on the sideline.
Are there any other capital market trends that you're watching right now, especially any that you feel are being overlooked or underreported in the market?
Well, I guess the only thing I would think of, and again, it's kind of like what I was talking about before, and that is dealing with a lot of lenders, debt funds, life companies, and banks have problem loans, and they're going to have to deal with those this next quarter. They're going to have to get them off their books. They're going to have to clean that up. And I just haven't seen, I actually expected in the fourth quarter of last year that we'd see a number of banks and a number of groups sell their portfolio of loans and get rid of some of the bad loans to clean up the balance sheet. That hasn't happened. And I thought, okay, maybe it's the first quarter. Now I think it's the second quarter and the third quarter when we're actually going to see that. So I think that's something I'm watching. And I do think that a lot of people are very frustrated. A lot of the money that's sitting on the sidelines, like some of these debt funds and opportunity funds, have raised so much money to go after the distressed debt. And the distressed debt really just hasn't shown up yet. It hasn't transacted. But it will. It will. And it's just going to take a little bit of time.
I'd like to hear some more about what Kennedy Wilson is doing in the market right now. For example, earlier this year, your shop's debt platform reached a milestone when it hit $7 billion in originations. And that followed a watershed deal last year, which was a $4.1 billion acquisition of a loan portfolio from Pacific Western Bank. It was both some of the largest transactions of their kind in recent memory. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that means for Kennedy Wilson's capabilities?
Sure. So Kennedy Wilson's a global real estate investment company with about $25 billion under assets. We got, the company has done, equity and credit through the years. They have a, basically they're huge in multifamily, got 38,000 units worldwide. And then also, about 20 some thousand square feet of office and industrial. So they have a big, broad range of expertise in the markets. But one of the things that, and they have been doing debt on and off for a number of years. And it's been very selective. It's been, bridge financing and some permanent financing primarily. And it's been a lot of relationships. That's what they did before. I was part of the Pacific Western Group. So I headed up the Pacific Western bank team that had originated the portfolio of construction loans. And that's what we sold to Kennedy Wilson in July of last year. And then with that, we brought over my whole team, both all of originations and all of asset management. And so what that's done for Kennedy Wilson is basically put us on the map to be able to lend, and we're really going to focus in on construction lending, and that's really what we're doing right now, is because that's what our expertise is, and that's where you're getting better yields than anything else. And our portfolio has been pristine. We did this for over 9 years at that bank, and we never had a loss. We never even had downgrades on any of our loans. So it's just been one of those things that it's been a great product type for them. And then the team that we're able to bring over, some of those people have been with me over 20 years at different places, but majority of them with me, 8 to 9 years at the bank. And so with Kennedy Wilson buying that portfolio and bringing the team over, it's allowed us to really amp up, because now we have, we had the team, but we just didn't have the capital anymore. And because we had issues at the bank, bank had a lot of issues. So it was a distressed seller, not a distressed portfolio. And so they had to sell it, but the portfolio has performed extremely well. Again, no issues. And what we're doing now is we've got another $4 billion of commitment from our investor, Fairfax, and we are putting that money out as we speak. And so it's allowed us to really establish ourselves as one of the premier construction lenders in the United States.
I guess according to conventional wisdom, some might say that it's almost counterintuitive to be in construction lending, but clearly that's a strength that your shop sees. And so I'm wondering what the more attractive asset categories and also circumstances, what you're looking for in construction loans right now, since there's certainly a lot more risk in the development, again, in the conventional view of things than in with stabilized assets.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, let me address the comment about construction being risky. It is. There's no question about it. It's a risky proposition, and what you need to do is you need to be able to have people in the team that know what they're doing. I've been doing this over 30 years, I've learned a lot of lessons through the years. And one of the nice things about this is, and our team has done this. This is what our team does, is construction lending. We have a portfolio team that does the asset management, that we're watching these deals every single every day, actually, and every month. And our origination team and our asset management team talk every single day on all these loans. And so we're constantly monitoring the deals. And if you look at what's going on in the world today, or since the Great Recession, the construction changed. The loan to cost on construction is lower. Banks as a whole were doing lower leverage transactions after the Great Recession. If you go before the Great Recession, we were doing construction loans and bridge loans and all types of loans at 75, 80%. And sometimes even if you imputed a lot of land equity, it might even be 90 plus percent, loan to cost deals. And you know, but with the Great Recession, everyone kind of, the world changed, and there now everything is done, you know, generally speaking, you have a senior loan that is, you know, 50 to 60% loan to cost, generally speaking, sometimes goes up to 65. And then there's a mezzanine lender behind you. And the mezzanine lender is another source of capital to protect the senior lender. So we have institutional mezzanine lenders that are behind us on many of these deals that actually are stronger than the borrower themselves. And if you think about what's getting done today in this market, the only, you know, the pie of deals that are getting done in construction has definitely shrunk from 2019 and even the last couple of years, just because the capital isn't there. The, trying to fill the whole capital stack has been very difficult. So if you think about it, if a borrower gets all the capital stack together, and the hardest piece right now is the limited partnership equity, that's probably that 75 to 90% or 95% of the equity of the capital stack, that is the hardest part. If they're getting that, you know that they are the premier developer, and only the premier developers are getting the money and be able to put the whole capital stack together. So if you think about that, one, you have the best developer, you have the best product, and you have a very safe, well-structured loan with a lot of capital behind you to protect, or ahead of you to protect you. So as a construction lender, I feel very comfortable with what we're doing. And again, what we sell, and I sell over and over, is the fact that we're not a commodity. You know, if you think construction lending and you're only doing it just because of pricing, then, you know, I don't want you as a borrower. I want a borrower that understands that when you have a problem on a construction, which you have a problem every single day by definition in construction, there's always a sub that doesn't show up, a sub that's in a fight with you, the sub that goes bankrupt, you have a crane situation, you have somebody die on site, we've had everything. You have subs go bankrupt, we've had GCs go bankrupt. It's how you deal with that borrower. And that's what we do, is like we step in and say, okay, let's fix this thing together. We're going to get you to the finish line. And so I actually like the construction better than I have liked, bridge lending in the past. The product that we're focused on right now, to answer the second part of your question, really is multifamily is the safest and best bet right now. All types of multifamily, and that includes build for rent and student housing and age restricted. So, and even condos in certain markets, in particular markets, we would do condos. But that's the product type. The second safest, I would say, is industrial. Industrial, I like industrial. It's a great product. I think the big box lending is kind of over with, but industrial with a mid-sized box and or a multiple number of buildings, you know, in a office or multifamily. An industrial park, that makes sense, you know, to do that. We're staying away from office. We're not really doing hotels at all right now either. Hotels are a business. We've done a lot of hotels in the past. You know, obviously we're at even lower leverage and with sponsors that we've had a good history with and a lot of, mezzanine or sub debt or preferred equity behind us somewhere. So we've been able to do those, but right now we're staying away from that. We want to see how that market turns and see how that performs over the next year or so. Office, we're staying away from office. You know, I mean, there might be some deal out there, but to me, it's just, we're not going to chase it for sure.
I'd like to turn to your own professional background and give our audience some perspective on what you bring to the table in your own journey in this business. For example, you bring a legal background to real estate finance. You practice law in both Iowa and California. You've advised clients on restructuring, loan workouts, and other really complicated tasks. So how did you make the transition from practicing law to being a real estate financier yourself? How did all that come about?
It kind of started really in law school, to be honest with you. I'm from Iowa. I went to the University of Iowa Law School. And while I was there, I was thinking about getting my MBA as well. And they had a joint program. And I was a business major. And so I took a couple classes when I was at law school on the business, on the MBA side. And that was, two of them were in high finance, and one of them is in real estate finance, kind of an advanced course. And I, for whatever reason, I just loved it. And the whole concept, which at that time I was pretty ignorant about leverage. And it was, the guy gave the example. I just fell in love with the class. I just thought it was the greatest class in the world. But then I practiced law in Iowa, a small town, with my father for 2 years there. And I loved it for a while. It was, I was kind of like, it's kind of like, you know, the old TV show Matlock. Anything that came in the door, you did. You know, I did divorce work. I did trial work. I did, we sold businesses. We represented businesses. We did real estate transactions, you know, always on a smaller basis because it's small, but I had great experience with it. But then I was like, okay, I'm living in Iowa. It was February. I needed to move to somewhere warmer. And so I moved to, I decided to move to San Diego. And San Diego was my, I didn't know a person in San Diego, but I fell in love when I came out there. I go, this is heaven. And so I moved to San Diego, got two job offers in mortgage banking. So someone told me I should look into that because I could maybe use my legal career. And so that's exactly what I did. I went to work in San Diego at Pacific Southwest Mortgage, and they hired me as a loan closer. And I actually just learned the business of closing all their loans and watching the originators originate the deals. And I would close their loans for them. And I just learned all the real estate aspect of it. And I watched the business people operate their way. And then I was kind of in between. And so I end up, after a couple of years doing that, I switched over to originations, and I partnered up with a senior originator who taught me an awful lot. The whole team taught me an awful lot about selling and working on it. But I used my legal background to understand stuff. And then, you know, whenever we got into a legal issue in the loan documents, I was always the person that could answer the question quicker or figure out what the issue was, or come help the lenders solve a problem. And so one of the things I learned early on was being a business person and also a lawyer. And yeah, I was able to kind of like bring the two together and figure out how to come to a solution. Like, is this really this is an important thing for a lawyer, but is that really important for the business? And so it may or may not be, and I had to kind of make that decision. And so each time that came up, I was able to kind of cut to the chase a lot quicker. And so through my career, I went back and I practiced law here in California. I practiced 2 years doing loan documentation work and workouts and those type of things, advising clients on that, but primarily representing more lenders than borrowers on that. And but anyway, I just kind of fell in love with all this. And I really wanted to be like, after a while, I was like, okay, I was an originator. Then I became a lawyer in the real estate. And I'm like, I want to get back in the game. You know, it's like in the Hamilton play, you want to be in the room where it happens, right? So
right.
It's that thing, right? So I want to be in the room where it happens. So I want to get back in the origination side. So I went to go work at a bank and started off as a loan officer, and then just kind of worked my way up and end up running the origination division for them. And basically learned the business as I was doing it. I mean, I used to be a life company. I represented life companies when I started, which was kind of very stable, simple product. And then after I practiced law, I got back working at a bank, and we were doing, you know, bridge lending, you know, a lot of moving structures to these deals. This is after the RTC situation, you know, time too. So there was a lot of creative stuff and all that. And, you know, you're doing workouts, you're figuring out things, we bought a big pool of loans and just learned a lot from that standpoint. Then we got into construction, and then we became, you know, we learned a lot in construction through the years, and we've done $30 billion in construction lending, you know, so we've seen pretty much everything. So that's what I did. I went into this, I've loved it ever since. All my family we're all from Iowa. I have five brothers. They all are really in the entertainment business out here in California. I'm the one person that has a real job. And then I have another brother that's a basketball coach, a college basketball coach. So I'm the only one that does the true, like, quote unquote, 9-to-5 type job.
So you're the, in other words, you're the black sheep of the family, right?
I'm the black sheep and the poor one in the family.
Yeah, well, it does sound that the even though your career has gone through a number of iterations, that real estate finance was kind of on your radar for really almost from the get-go, really, from since you were in law school. You were saying that
at one time too, even before that, in college, after my sophomore year, I worked for 2 years before that. I had worked for a home builder. And in our small town, and he built the best homes in our town, right? So, and I thought I was almost going to quit school after my sophomore year to go work for him and become a, and I wanted to have my own home building business. And still down deep today, I would love to develop, subdivision or something like that. Maybe that's my next career in 10, 15 years. We'll see.
I'd like to jump into a couple of things that Kennedy Wilson has been involved with this year. And for example, one in particular that is in a real estate category that is getting an awful lot of attention right now. A couple of months ago, of course, you announced that your shop is providing a construction loan in $96 million for a project called Tidelock, which is a mixed-use waterfront project in the Old Town neighborhood of Alexandria, Virginia. And the sponsors, Community 3 and Whitaker Investment, are going to be converting three office buildings into 169 apartments, 65 condos, and about 7,000 square feet of commercial. One of the reasons that there's a lot of discussion about office to multifamily, of course, is that there's so much demand for new multifamily product at the same time that there's a significant inventory of office that's considered obsolete. But as we also know, turning office properties to multifamily involves significant technical challenges because of the structural differences between the two property types. What is it about Tidelock that makes it a viable conversion and an example of a sound candidate for office to residential conversion?
Paul, you hit it right on the head. There's been so much discussion on this topic of all these conversion deals, and there's hundreds of buildings that are available that could be converted possibly. But, I would actually say that's the exception, not the rule. And for what you basically have said, we've looked at probably dozens and dozens of these deals and underwrote them and looked at them. But, the first thing we look at, we've done five or six of them. And what we do is we look at them as you got to look at the floor plate. That's the very first thing is the floor plate. And then the parking issue, so if your floor plates are too big or too square, it's going to be difficult because you're going to have too much wasted space in your building. And the ideal situation is a kind of a rectangular building, floor plates, rectangular floor plates. So you don't have these real deep apartment units, which are look like bowling alleys, so you can't have that. So again, that's the first thing we look at on those. The other thing too, is that we're always concerned about the post-tension concrete that you have. And then you're drilling, you got to drill holes, right? You got to do vertical holes, for your piping and for plumbing and electric. And you're going to cut into some of the rebar and post-tension rebar. Then that, you can do a little bit of that, but you don't want to lose the structure of the building. So you can't go through too much of that rebar at all. I mean, one or two, on a floor might not kill you, but you can't do much. So many times when you're trying to line up one floor to the next floor, it doesn't line up that piping. So instead of having a straight line, like if you're going to build a regular apartment project today, your sewer line and your electrical lines all come down the same piping. Here, they're going to have jig and jag all the way down, to make it work. And that's not efficient. It's going to cost you more. You're always going to run into cost overruns, much more cost overruns in these deals. So what we liked about the Tidelock deal is that this was 10,000 square feet rectangular floor plate, which laid out perfectly for this residential conversion. So you didn't have the deep bowling alley floor plates. There's one garage, one singular garage underneath the three buildings. Okay, and if you think about it, in a in an office building, and these old office buildings, some of them, they're built with either a 3 or 4 to 1 parking ratio. Okay. So that's 3 or 4 parking ratios per 1,000 square feet. Your average apartments, let's say is 1,000 feet. So that means you have 3 or 4 parking stalls available for that space. So we were able in this one actually to add 5 stories on each of these buildings. So we have three buildings now that are all like 3 stories, and then we're going to add 4 and 5 stories on top of each one of them. Now, and then the floor plate, fortunately, the floor plate's laid out really well for the apartment conversion. And in addition, they're able to get more units to be able to have water views on the Potomac River. In Washington, D.C., it's a really low percentage of land that has a private access to the river, to waterways. It's all owned by government and all that. So that made this thing even special and desirable, this location, that market. Obviously, old Alexandria is super tight and good. So all that kind of laid out. And then if you think about the units above that we're going to build, you can build those, any way you want. So we're able to build, like on the condo building, we're going to make bigger units than we normally would on the upper floors, because you can demand a higher price, and you can lay it out differently on top, because it's all being new built on top. So all those reasons made this thing extremely compelling deal. The sponsors know what they're doing. They have Clark Construction, which is one of the best contractors in the country, on top of it. I mean, it has had everything together, and the views there are fantastic. When we walked to the roof, we thought this would be a great place to live. So,
and also, it just sounds like that the idea of adding stories of stacking additional apartments above the existing structure adds some interest as well, and challenges to the process. If you're increasing the loads on the foundation and the existing structure.
That's actually a good point. And so that's why we had Clark, and we had our construction consultant, mm-hmm. Morris construction consultant, look at that, the load factor, could they take it? Now, this thing was built, I think, in the 70s or 80s. I mean, this is like a fortress, this building. So those are the ones that work the best, the fortresses, and small floor plates.
I'd like to turn briefly to a couple of other asset categories. And you mentioned that on the one hand, that the office sector certainly has its challenges, to say the least, these days, but that in addition to multifamily, that you're also finding the industrial sector to be pretty attractive. What do you find to be a good viable kind of financing scenario for industrial? Is it, again, the on the development side?
Yeah, we focus in on the development side. I think, bridge and construction, bridge and permanent financing in industrial is fine as well. I'd like to have, if I was going to invest in or lend on those, I would want an industrial park, meaning, 5 or 6 buildings together, and they could range maybe 100,000 square foot, building up to 500,000 square foot buildings, maybe have 1 million square feet. At this point in time, in this part of the cycle, I wouldn't want to go after the whale or the elephant, the 1 million square foot user, because, it's like you've seen Amazon, pull back on that. And it's like, how many other, users are there out there for that? Now, you can subdivide some of those, but they probably don't work as well. So I'd probably stay away from that. But I do like the industrial parks overall. I think that creates an environment that's good, and it lessens your risk on that. The Inland Empire out here in California is, anywhere in Southern California is just, they're going to get leased. Everything gets leased here. It's crazy. And there's a number of markets around the country. We know some in New Jersey, there's some really strong markets. Baltimore even has some great markets. And Ohio, ones, recent ones that we've looked at that are really good. And we're going to venture into that that product type soon.
One of the things that's kind of striking about industrial is that it, even considering all of the new product that's been developed over the last 10 years, let's say, that there still is demand for more. And is that, from what you're seeing out there, is that because of the there are opportunities just for infill on the one hand? Is it also because the product that's out there is some of it, a lot of it is obsolete and just needs to be replaced, or that there's opportunities to create something more competitive, or a more competitive product out there? What seems to be driving the demand for new product, even at this stage in the cycle?
Yeah, I think it's the new product, the, you know, having the higher clear heights and all that, and to making sure you have great access. And, you know, that's the most important thing. You know, the smaller obsolete ones, unless there's a lot of land with it, those can't get redeveloped as easily, because they just, you can't build it. If you have a, let's say, a 15, 20,000 square foot box, you only have so much land, right? And so you really can't tear that down, and you can tear it down and build, but it's like, you're probably going to do fine. And there's enough tenants out there that want a little bit cheaper being in a B property. And if you only need 10, 15, 20,000 square feet, you don't need a 36 clear height, right? So I think that's a big part of it. And there's always a need for it. I think the last mile distribution has been a big thing. And I think it continues. People want that. There's, you know, I don't see, I know there's always these reports that, you know, FedEx is down or whatever, but, you know, I see packages constantly coming to our office and our home all the time. So I'm not too worried about that part of it. I think there's going to be distribution and last mile needs in a big way. And then also, I do think that even in manufacturing, I think, and we're seeing some strong manufacturing growth as well. So I think that's been a strong market. I mean, it's obviously in every industrial project you look at, you just have to look at what the demand drivers and the location and access to the freeway and to the population. And if that's where all these industrial are at, and that's where they're getting built. And actually, in some markets, they're putting restrictions on industrial because of the pollution aspect of it. So, they aren't going to be able to build just, you know, willy-nilly on these things. They're still being restricted.
Thomas, we all know the office sector is really challenged right now on a number of fronts. But as you look at the market, are there areas that still offer some potential out there?
Yeah, no, office, obviously, like we said before, it's a difficult asset class right now, especially since the pandemic. But, you know, I think that if you have a well amenitized and well located office building, you will do okay and do fine. Now, if you take, for example, here in LA, Century City it may be the best or one of the best markets in the United States. It's well over 95%. It's getting record rents. They're actually building a new office building, a high rise that is, I think, 40 or 50% pre-leased already. So there are certain markets. Why is that market doing so well? It's well located, and two, it's safe and with all the amenities. Now you take for, and also I think like anything that's well located and transit oriented has potential to be very successful. Again, with the right amenities. The places where they're having difficulty and where we don't have a solution yet, but we're going to need a solution or very many solutions on this, is that, you know, places where it's not safe. If it's not safe, I mean, I just read an article in the Wall Street Journal today about St. Louis and how the downtown St. Louis was extremely unsafe and difficult, and it's, you know, it's emptying out. You know, you see downtown LA, downtown Portland, Seattle, San Francisco. Now there's certain parts of those downtowns that are coming back slowly here, but until those cities and tenants can feel like they're safe, I don't see a big return on that. So I would stay away from those. And one of my issues with office always in general is that you, as an owner, you continue to rebuy that building over and over. As soon as a tenant leaves, you have to like come in, find a new tenant, so you have the downtime. And then you have to give them free rent. And then you also have to give them a big TI package. And so, you know, it takes a long time to recoup that money, and you just put in a bunch more money in that space, you know? So I just have had a kind of a negative opinion of office before the pandemic because of the rebuy-in. And I just see the reason why, if you really think about in the last 10 years before the, let's say before the pandemic, where office created its value was cap rate compression. Cap rates went from 9 to 5 or whatever. That's where the value was made, not anywhere else. I mean, that's that majority of it was. Anyway, that's where the value was, the overall value for office. And so, you know, you can't count on cap rate compression, especially when you're rebuying your units over and over, your building over and over.
Well, Tom, now we come to one of my favorite parts of the Investment Matters series, executives off the clock. You know, nobody can work 24/7, even though it sure seems like we try sometimes. So when it's time for a break from the daily grind, is there anything that you like to do as a change of pace?
Sure. About 5 years ago, I picked up golf. I have two daughters, and you know, they had been to college and out. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, okay, I need to have some type of hobby. So I picked up golf, right before, a year before COVID. Started taking lessons and all that. And then I joined a club here in LA. And if on the weekends, if I can do it, it's actually good for business as well to take people out. You know, I think I have found it's a great challenge for me. It's frustrating as anything I've ever done, but I love it. I'm not that good, but I enjoy it. And it's a lot of fun. It's also a good way to get to know people really well. Especially in the business, you know, if you spend 5 hours with somebody and you enjoy that time, you know, you have a good chance to do business together. So I've kind of mixed the business and pleasure together on that. But on the weekends, I really do enjoy that. I'm too old now for my knees. My knees hurt too much to run anymore or play basketball, which I used to do a lot. So now I'm stuck with golf, the most frustrating game there is.
But it still gets you out in the fresh air. And you get your steps in.
Absolutely. And the great thing is here in California, Southern California, it's 12 months a year. So we get that benefit. So we're pretty fortunate. I'm very fortunate.
You don't have to worry about going out and playing in the snow like you would have in Iowa.
Right. Exactly. My blood is thinned since I've moved to California.
Well, Tom Weitzel, it's been a real pleasure having you here today on Investment Matters. I really enjoyed hearing your insights about the real estate capital markets and investment and what's going on in your shop as well. So thanks for making time.
Paul, thank you very much. You have a great day.
That was my conversation with Tom Weitzel, head of the Debt Investment Group at Kennedy Wilson. Please join me next time for another conversation with a leading commercial real estate investment executive. You can find archived episodes of Investment Matters and more CPE podcasts on Apple Podcasts and on our website, commercialsearch.com. Before you go, let me take a moment to tell you about an exciting opportunity. The CPE Executive Council is a group of industry leaders who exchange ideas about trending real estate issues. Highlights of their discussions are posted on our website and featured in our newsletters. If you're interested in joining the council, please contact CPE's Editor-in-Chief, Jessica Feer, at jessica.feer@cpe-mhn.com. Again, that's jessica.feer@cpe-mhn.com. Until next time, thanks for listening and be well.